For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Let me just take a few minutes. Let's just catch everybody up as to what we accomplished last week. So we are going through Yaakov and Esav, the three different episodes that the Torah discusses their interactions. We are in the midst of the second of those three interactions. The second of the three interactions is where Yitzchak, the father, calls Esav in to be blessed, sends him out to the field to get himself a nice tasty dish. In the meanwhile, of course, as we know, Rivka overhears the whole thing, sends her son Yaakov in, he intercepts the brachas, and then has to flee for his life. That's the 3-second overview of the story. We went through Rashi, Ramban. We're now doing Rav Hirsch. We're going to finish up. We started yesterday. We'll go over that quickly right now, what we did, and then we'll continue that. Hopefully we'll be able to finish up today, and then we'll really get started in the third episode, really starting from the top. Meretz Hashem soon. In any case, quick review of what Rav Hirsch understood last week. In very poetic and beautiful language, Rav Hirsch went through the difficulty of this, what he called a comedy act. It's just impossible to understand what was Rivka thinking, trying to pull this off, getting her son dressed up, putting some goat hairs. Excuse me. I feel bad for people listening online. They're going to be like jumping in there. What was she thinking, he asks. She has to have known she was going to be caught. She has to have known there was a major risk that Yitzchak himself would have figured it out, that the son standing in front of him was not the correct son. And what was she going to do when Esau figured it out? Well, it's a comedy routine, he said. It's such a simplistic attempt at hoping that Yaakov will be able to get all dressed up and get into the room fast enough, feed his father the meal, get the bracha, get out. How did it work? And he presented a fascinating and a rather unique theory that indeed her entire intention was to get caught. That's what he presented. She has been, in his argument, arguing for a long time with her husband Yitzchak, that Yaakov is the true son who really needs to be receiving all of the blessings, that Esav is not what he seems to be. And he suggests and posits that Yitzchak has over and over said to her, you don't understand, Esav's not who you think he is, he's really a good guy, he really is possible to be part of this whole package. And over again she says, don't give him the bracha yet, wait. Eventually she's sure that it will become clear who Esav really is. And at the very end, when Yitzchak now desires to give him the bracha, she says, you know what, I'm going to prove to him how easy it is indeed to fool him. And look what I'm going to do. I'm going to get Yaakov dressed up as Esav. And if even Yaakov, the Ishtam, the simple man, the man who sits and studies all day, if even he can fool you into thinking that he's an Esav, how much more so would it be simple for Esav to get all dressed up and fool you into thinking he's really like a Yaakov? And in so doing, he suggests a very novel approach that the entire purpose was to get caught. The entire purpose was to show her husband how possible it is to fool him, so that he would come to the recognition and the realization that indeed he has been fooled, and that Yaakov is the only true son who should be worthy of the brachas. That's we saw very briefly. We went through it at length last week. We'll pick up on page 443. So in your sheets, we're on page 443. We'll continue reading it inside. As we go through it first, we read it inside. His language is compelling enough that it's just worth reading it alone inside. So we're going to pick up from the second paragraph from the bottom. This also seems to be the way. So again, that's the approach that he's working with, that now that Yitzchak has been become aware of the fact that he's foolable, that indeed his son Yaakov came in and fooled him, he then says to his son Esav, V'gam baruch yihyeh, he shudders a great shock as he realizes, and then he says, V'gam baruch yihyeh, he then bestows the bracha upon Yaakov for real. As we mentioned, one of the questions that he had asked was, how does it work? You give a bracha and you give it to the wrong person and it works? Where's the divine element of, you can't do that? So he said, now he's v'gam baruch yihyeh. At the end of the bracha, he says that this is the way that it should be. Yaakov is indeed the only one who should receive this bracha. This also seems to be the way that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi takes this episode. In the Medrash, Rav Hirsch quotes the Medrash. We'll just read the English side of it. Not just because Rivka loved Yaakov more than Esav did she do this. It wasn't that she loved that son more, but so that the latter should no longer come and deceive his old father. So Rav Hirsch sees in that Medrash that when Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says Rivka did this so that Esau should no longer be able to deceive his father, he's seeing in that she needs to uncover what he's been doing. That look how easy it is to fool you. Look what one can do. Even Yaakov can pull it off. A closer consideration of the blessing that Yitzhak wished to confer on Esau could make his behavior much clearer. Now, what we're going to do, or first is going to do, remember what he said in the beginning, for those of you who were here last week, he's going to go through the three principal players in this scene. What was each one thinking? We started with Yaakov. What was Yaakov thinking in this whole thing? So, we said Yaakov was, he was thinking nothing. He was a very passive participant in this entire episode. From his mother calls him in, says to him, this is what you'll do. Go here, get me this, wear this, bring the food, get the bracha. He really is just an obedient son listening to his mother. What was Rivka thinking? So that we just finished. She was thinking she was going to uncover Esau's ability to fool his father by contriving this entire plan. What was Yitzchak thinking this whole time? What was he thinking that he wanted to bestow the blessing, the bracha, upon Esau? What, was he really that fooled? Did he really think that Esav was the bigger tzaddik? What was his plan in this whole episode? So Rav Hirsch takes the following approach, and I've seen this, a very similar approach to Rav Hirsch. We're going to see in Rav Hirsch. My Rosh Hashiva of Goldova from Kiryat Yavna has a very similar idea that Rav Hirsch has. We'll take a look at that now. A closer consideration of the blessing that Yitzchak wished to confer could make his behavior. Look at the bracha. We're in the last paragraph on page 443. Yeah. Esav himself had not expected that his father wished to give him the whole of the blessing. Even Esav never expected he was supposed to get everything. And the proof to that is when Esav, Yitzchak gives the first blessing out. And then all of a sudden Yaakov leaves stage right, Esav comes in stage left, and then Esav discovers that he's been fooled, that somebody has come in, his brother has come in and taken the bracha. And what does he say? He says, Father, haven't you saved a bracha for me? What did he mean, haven't you saved a bracha for me? His father thought that was him. Yeah, okay. But he knows that there were two sons. Esav knows you were never intending to give me everything. Haven't you saved one for me? There's got to be something that you were intending to give to my younger brother Yaakov. So give me that bracha. There has to be something left for me. He at once asked his father, Halo itzaltali bracha, have you then not kept one blessing back for me? I.e., as Rav Hirsch understands, if you had blessed me, meaning even if I was who you thought I was, you would certainly still have had a blessing left to give to Yaakov. So, well, at least give me that bracha. And Yitzchak readily admitted that. He said, absolutely, of course I didn't give him everything. I saved one. But are you fit for that bracha? Are you fit for the bracha that I would have held back to give to my son Yaakov? So now it's been reversed. So is it so simple that you could just reverse the blessings and say, okay, the bracha that I was supposed to give to Esav, turns out it was Yaakov. So now the bracha that I'll give to Yaakov, I'll instead give to Esav. So Yitzchak says it doesn't work that way. The bracha that Esav was supposed to get, Yaakov took. But that doesn't entitle you to the bracha Yaakov was supposed to get. In fact, you have no connection to that bracha, as the first shall write. But in describing the blessing, now it's going to get a little bit confusing. Make sure you find page 444. The pages are upside down and backwards. But in describing the blessing that he had given to Yaakov, he showed him how this blessing was intended and suitable for Esav. But the blessing he had reserved in his mind for Yaakov would be quite unsuitable for Esau. You were going to get one set of blessings. That if you recall, when we went through before the summer, when we went through in depth the language of the bracha that he was given to, the first bracha that he gives, which was intended for Esau and ends up in the hands of Yaakov, it was a very materialistic blessing. It was a blessing of the dew of the heavens and the fat of the earth, and nations will be subservient to you. It was a blessing of succeeding in this world. the next bracha that he gives to Yaakov before Yaakov leaves to run to Haran, to his uncle Lavan, that was the spiritual bracha of Avraham. That was the continuation of all of the dynasty that Avraham had started. That has no connection to Esav. Now, Rav Hirsch writes as follows, and again, I'm going to add to this as we go through from Rav Goldberg, who says almost the exact same thing. Two elements were represented in his house by his two sons. In Esav, material power. In Yaakov, spiritual. Now, again, I'm going to borrow, this is not Rav Hirsch's language, but I want to borrow from Rav Yeshiva, who has almost the exact same approach. When you think of, let's just take a yeshiva as a model. So when the way yeshiva functions, you say, what are the components of a yeshiva? So you have the Rosh Yeshiva who teaches Torah. That's the goal of the yeshiva. What's the stated goal? It's to teach students Torah. In order for the Rosh Yeshiva to be able to teach Torah to the students, there has to be an executive director who makes sure that the electricity bills are paid and that the funds are raised to pay the electricity bills, that there's a kitchen, that there's a staff, that there are all the elements that go into functioning. The Rosh Yeshiva can say, I want to teach Torah all he wants. Somebody has to make sure that there's an environment there that allows for the Torah to be taught. Which one is more important? It's a tricky question. They're both important because neither can function without the other. But the goal is to teach Torah. That's what we do here. We don't raise money. Our goal isn't to raise money. Our goal is to teach Torah. We have to raise money in order to be able to do that. You have to have material power. That's not the goal, though. The goal in Torah thought in Judaism is never to have material power for the sake of material power. It's in order to allow for the spiritual quest of the Jewish people to be fulfilled, and it's an absolutely necessary partnership to have the material together with the spiritual. Yitzchak sees he has two sons. He sees an Esav who's an Ish Hasadah right away. They develop. By the time they're 13, he's a man of the field. He's a man who knows how to run the world. He's a man who knows how to interact, get things done, to build, to create. And he sees he has a Yaakov who's an Ishtam, who's a man who sits and dwells in the tents, who's going to be a learner, who's going to be a Rosh Yeshiva. And he sees in his sons a perfect partnership. My son Yaakov is going to be the Rosh Yeshiva, and my son Esav is going to make sure that the Yeshiva functions. He's going to be the material power. He's going to make sure that the Jewish people as a whole function materialistically. But they function as a team. And Yitzchak saw that. Says Rav Hirsch, as we're going to see inside in a moment, it was not that he thought Esav was a Rosh Yeshiva. He was not fooled into thinking Esav was going to be the one giving shir. But he thought, he was fooled into thinking that Esav wanted a part in the partnership. That he wanted a role. That he wanted to be on the team. He was fooled into it. He did think that.
Even after he got married.
Even after he got married, it seems that way, because he still wants to give him this bracha. Let's see it inside. Again, there were two elements represented in the house by his two sons. Esav is material power, and Yaakov represents the spiritual power. Yitzchak knew quite well that both these factors were necessary for the prosperity of the nation. You cannot have one without the other. It doesn't work. It doesn't function. Further, Yitzchak probably knew of the prophecy, V'rav Ya'avod Tzair, that the older one will serve the younger one. Now again, this is taking sides on a big issue which we've discussed many, many times. If you go back to episode number one, the first time we're introduced to Yaakov and to Esav, it's in utero still. Rivka is pregnant with twins, and she's suffering, and she seeks an answer from the prophet, from the yeshiva of Shem V'Aver, and she's told a prophecy which included two twins in your belly, two different mites, will pass from one to the other, but the older will serve the younger. And we mentioned many times, did she ever tell this to her husband Yitzchak? Does Yitzchak know, A, that there were going to be twins, B, that one was going to be might, that there were two powerful nations, and that power would shift from one to the other, and that the younger would be the one in control, that the older one, who was Esav, would serve it? Did he know that or not? So we had reasons. We had reasons to say yes. We had reasons to say no. The text, the Chumash, gives us, doesn't tell us. Simply doesn't say. Rav Hirshir is suggesting he did know that. That Rivka indeed told her. Ramban, if you remember, said she did not tell him that. And The Ramban, when we were learning through the Ramban, asks the question, why does she come up with this whole game? Why not just tell him? Why doesn't she go in and say, my dear husband, you're making a mistake, and I received a prophecy about it. So, it's 60 years already.
Yeah.
Prophecy happened a long time ago. She was concerned it wouldn't go over well. But he was under the impression that Yitzchak never knew that prophecy. First, he's going to take a different approach. He knew. He knew that the elder would serve the younger, which made perfect sense in the way that he was viewing it. Which one, if you have the Rosh Hashiva and the executive director, which one, if you had to say it in this way, serves the other, the executive director, now, with apologies to all executive directors out there, serves the Rosh Hashiva. Because the stated goal of a yeshiva is to teach, that's what yeshivas do. Now, maybe in other institutions you could debate, but in a yeshiva, in a school, the school's job is to teach its students. The principal is principal. And the executive director allows the principal to function and do what he needs to do, to hire the teachers, teach the children. That's the goal. So Yitzchak would see the prophecy that the elder serves the younger. That makes perfect sense. The elder, which trait did the elder develop into? The elder developed Esav into the man of the field. Of course he will serve the younger. That makes sense. The younger, Mayakov, is the Rosh Hashiva type. Continues Refersh. So he's aware of this prophecy that the one who is materially stronger would ultimately serve the materially weaker one. But Yitzchak could have believed that the Abrahamic calling was to be carried on by an Esav and a Yitzchak in brotherly, that should be Yaakov, in brotherly unison, each one complementing the other, and therefore intended giving Esav a blessing of material content, but for Yaakov, content, but for Yaakov, a spiritual one. So he reverses no problem with the fact that he intended to give Esav the bracha. The bracha was focused on materialism. That's what Esav needed. He was fooled. But he was only fooled into thinking, not that he was a tzaddik like Yaakov, but that he had bought into the program and was going to play the role that was destined for him. But the blessing which he had reserved for Yaakov, the spiritual blessing which the Rosh Yeshiva type needed, would have no meaning for Esav, whose temperament and feelings were not inclined to this part of the house of Avraham. And therefore, when Esav says, but didn't you save one for me? Give me the one you were going to give to my brother Yaakov. To that, Yitzchak says, yes, I saved one, but no way you're getting that. That's not for you. Even when I was fooled, I didn't think that was for you. Certainly now that I realized you are who you are, that's not going to you. But Rivka, now here again, Refersh is a much more modern thinker, takes the experience in a different way. We didn't see this in the Ramban. Says Refersh, where did Rivka grow up?
Love.
She grew up in Lavan's house. Where did Yitzchak grow up? Yitzchak grew up in the house of Avram. Yitzchak grew up in the home of a tzaddik, an Avram Avinu, a Sarah Imenu. He was born to them when they were already elderly. He grew up in a certain type of home. So when he now has children, he sees different strengths, but of course this can work as a partnership, all within the realm of a life of Torah following the Abrahamic way. His wife, Rivka, didn't grow up in a home like the home of Avram and Sarah. She grew up in the home of Lavan. She knew wickedness when she saw it. She grew up in that home. She sees her son Esav and doesn't see him the way her husband Yitzchak does. Says her first inside, but Rivka knew from Lavan in her own home the impossibility and the failure of such a division. She knew from experience how the material too could blossom to blessing and true happiness only in a home in which the spirit of Avraham hovers, only by a hand guided by the spirit. She knew what was right. She recognized the curse that arises out of materialism, which is devoid of spirit, and can only see blessing blossoming undivided on a single head. Such reflections can make the behavior of both parents understandable. Let us now look at the text. Says Refersh, when you look at it from the perspective of the homes that they came, and you look at the three primary components of the story, Yitzchak, Rivka, and then their son Yaakov, makes sense. Yitzchak, the father, who grew up in a home of an Avraham, sees in his two sons materialism, spiritualism, but they're both in. I want to give them both my bracha. He was fooled. But he was fooled only in thinking that the materialistic approach of Esav was a Torah-based materialistic approach, when indeed Esav really wanted nothing to do with it. Rivka, who grew up in a different home, saw through it. She saw this won't work. And Esav is not, he's not in. He cannot carry. Now his language implies that he holds it can never work in two heads, which eventually it does. In other words, Yaakov, who takes them both, has two sons. He has a Zvulun and a Yisachar. He's going to create partnership types of within the 12 sons that he's going to have. But at this level of the Esav and the Yaakov, she sees Esav is not in. He doesn't want it. So she then comes up with this whole plot to fool her husband Yitzchak, the goal of which to show him how easy it is and possible it is to indeed fool him, which works. And then both brachas end up being bestowed upon Yaakov. We're going to take a look at a couple of things inside. I want to just parenthetically comment here. When my Rosh Hashiva, when he discusses this, he adds a component to this, which is a large component. I'll just mention it briefly. You're familiar, when you go through the Chumash, when the Torah introduces us to the two wives of Yaakov, Leah and Rachel. So the Torah introduces us to the idea that Rachel is the younger of the two sisters, Leah the elder, and Leah is red-eyed from tears. And the sages say, why was she crying so much? Because it was known there were two sons to Lavan, and two sons to his sister Rivka, two daughters to Lavan, and two sons to Rivka. And the elder was going to marry the elder, the other was going to marry the younger. So that Leah was supposed to marry Esav, and Yaakov was going to marry Rachel, except that Esav now became this big Rasha, and so she's crying now what she's supposed to do. And what ends up happening? She gets switched for Rachel and into the marriage. The Medrash has the language that in the morning Yaakov says to her, you're a sinister, the daughter of a sinister. Your father is a foolish, is a fooling kind of guy. And now look at you too. You played along with this whole thing the whole night. You're not who I thought you were. And she says to him, says the Medrash, where do you think I learned it from? I learned it from you. Was it not you who walked in to your father and said, it is I, Esav, your firstborn? Didn't you fool your father? So the Rosh Hashiva learned that the Medrash is saying something more than just this cute play that she has one up on him. When Yaakov comes in and dresses up as Esav, putting his clothing on his skin, fooling his father, stealing the bracha, what he did is he took Esav's portion of the partnership. It was supposed to be spiritual, material, separate. The material component said, I don't want to be part of this. Esav says, I'm out. Rivka sees that and says to Yaakov, you have to take that. You have to be that. You need to be able to work in this world too. You can't just sit in the base of Medrash anymore. You need to now get dressed up. You need to be a little deceiving. You need to be conniving, and you need to get out there and fool your father and steal a bracha, which is against your nature. Nature is to sit and learn and to be honest and truthful and do all the things. You need to do that. And when he does, he takes Esav's bracha. And in effect, he took the two components, the spiritual and the material, which were originally going to be on two separate sons, and he made it all now into the train, the thread of Yaakov, and then through him he has 12 sons and everything gets figured out. But it's all now through him. Well, when he took that role, he also took the wife, the partner, the completion of that role. So it might have been Esav was going to marry Leah and Yaakov was going to marry Rachel when everybody was part of the program. When Yaakov takes Esav's role in the materialistic element, he also takes his wife, Leah, which Chazal say in the phrase, I learned this from you. When you fooled your father, you got me. I became the partner of that element of that part of your avoda, your goal, your mission in life. There's much more to be said about that. But just that's part of what happens in this story when Yaakov comes in and takes this approach of taking the material elements of the bracha. There are other ramifications of that which play itself out as well. Says a verse further on. He's going to take a look at some of these specific psukim to further some of the ideas that he's expressed here. Now, what could have been Yitzchak's motive, bottom of page 444, what could have been his motive in saying to his son whom he wishes to bless, first cook a nice dish for me? Let's get back to this question, which we've dealt with many, many times as far as the question. What a strange thing. He's ready to give his son a bracha, and he says, but first, there's a certain type of cut of steak that I really like. So before I give you this bracha, take all your stuff, go out to the field, prepare for me tasty dishes just the way I like it. Why? What's the meaning of that? One has tried to find a parallel case with Elisha and his request for stringed music. We find a similar idea that the prophet Elisha also asks for some music to be played before bestowing blessings, as if a good piece of roast meat had some power to inspire lofty feelings. Very strange things, he says. You know, roast meat is good, but talking about the split between material and spiritual, from where do we see that geschmack, tasty material steak will enhance the ability of the spiritual? Now, there are lots of approaches to this question. We're just going to see Rav Hirsch's approach.
Is there any opinion that it was filet mignon that he was requesting?
I don't know. Okay, let's go to the next paragraph to see where he starts his answer. Consequently, here too, the meaning may be clear as follows. 445. Yitzchak wanted to bless Esav in the sense of his future calling, according to the way that we've been learning in Refresh here. What's the future calling of Esav? In the second paragraph on page 445. What's the calling? That he's going to be in control of the material wealth and power of the Jewish people. And what is he going to use that material wealth and power for? To support the yeshiva. That's his calling. You have the ability to function in the world. You have the ability to be the man of the field. You have the ability to do all of those things for the sake of creating the spiritual. As he hoped that his natural tendencies would come to be employed for useful moral purposes, so Yitzchak's dream is that Esav channel all of his strengths and talents and abilities out there in the field to supporting spiritual pursuits. He wanted him to show that he was turning in that direction at the time he received the blessing. So it's almost a father's desperate plea, a hope, a push to get him to take those talents and move them in the right direction. Show me as you receive these blessings that that's what you're using your talents for. Let him for once employ his wild sport for a true humane purpose. Someone who's a man in the field who likes to hunt. What does it mean he likes to hunt? So he likes to hunt for food or he likes to hunt for game? He likes to show his prowess out there in the field. Writes Refersh, for it certainly seems that this hunting of Esav's was not usually pursued for the purpose of providing his old, weak father with a strengthening meal. That's not what Esav was going out to the fields regularly to do. What he enjoyed was the hunt for its own sake. The sight of the steaming blood gushing out after pitting his wits against the brute strength and evasive cunning of the animals. His language is always so beautiful, poetic, and descriptive. No, he's taking that which we know from the Medrash and from the Pesukim about Esav and assume this is what it means to be writing a commentary of the Chumash. It seems, he writes, that he was a hunter for the sake of being a hunter, the thrill of the hunt, of the kill, of the strategy, of the pitting, as he writes, my wits against the wits of the cunning and strength of the animal. But to hunt, to provide refreshment for somebody who was weak and ill, would not enter Esav's mind. It was not in his character to do so. So his father Yitzchak says, I'd like to now bestow the blessing upon you. It's a blessing of material blessings. But my goal for you in the material blessings is to provide for others, is to be a source of support to the spiritual pursuits of your brother. Therefore, quote, for once, gather up the weapons of your daily occupation and stalk some game, and you yourself prepare a dainty dish for me. I want you now, for once, to use your love of hunting, but for a benevolent purpose. for the refreshment of an old man. I want you to feel for once how good it feels to use one's strength and skill to give someone else pleasure. Says the first, that's what it, the material, you know, the spiritual element of that partnership is in some senses a lot easier. It's in a similar way why Yom Kippur is an easier day than Purim. Yom Kippur is clear. This is what we're doing. We're fasting. It's hard. It's spiritual. There's no earthly materialistic pursuits. We're supposed to be focused on this. It's a spiritual day. So as hard as it is for us to be spiritual, but at least it's clear what we're supposed to be doing. Try having that same spiritual high on Purim. You're all dressed up, and you have a big meal, and you're running around doing fun. It's just, it's harder to feel spiritual and to be channeled in a spiritual way when you're involved in material things. Which is why on Yom Kippur, the Torah takes away all the material things. On the one day the Torah says, today you're like the malachim, you're like the angels. So remove yourself from the physical. Remove yourself from your shoes, from food, from anointing, from all the things that we do. From what? Today you're spiritual. So Esav's task is in a way harder. It's to be material, to be involved in the field, to be involved in the hunt, to be involved in the game, but not to get lost that I'm doing it for myself. Not to get lost that I'm doing it for the thrill of the kill and the challenge, but to remember that I'm doing it for the pleasure of being able to provide for someone else who doesn't have. That's a challenge. And again, in many ways, a much bigger challenge. So what does Yitzchak do before he bestows the bracha on him? So before he bestows the bracha, he says, I need you to engage that. I need you to take everything that you have, all your talents, your strength, your skill out there in the field, but I want it to be done solely for the purpose of someone else. For no other purpose other than to provide me. So I give you instructions. If you remember the verses, you have that strength. Take your bow and your arrow. Like, he's talking to the professional. The old man who can barely see is talking to the professional and says, and don't forget your arrow. You're talking to Esav. This is the expert. He says, I will take all of your stuff, take all of your tools, and go out there for me. Go out there to provide for someone else, says Rav Hirsch. That is also why, five lines from the bottom, that is also why, in the blessing he gave to the supposed Esav, meaning he thought he was giving the bracha to Esav, what does he say? He led him from the joy of hunting over to that of agriculture, to the field blessed by God. He's trying to push him, yes, you're a man of the field, but let's move away from the thrill of the kill into providing for others through agriculture as well, with an eye to the prosperity of the future Jewish national life. This becoming refreshed, and this receiving the blessing by having brought about the refreshment, meaning the refreshed sense of Esav's ability to provide for someone else, lies in the Ba'avor Tivarechecha Nafshi. When Yitzchak says, feed me, he didn't just say so that I may bless you, he says so that my soul might bless you. Says Rav Hirsch, that is what Yitzchak wanted. I want you to take your material power, strength, talents, and skills to go out and hunt. Hunt for me so that then my soul will be elevated in seeing what you can accomplish and then bestow that material blessing upon you so that you can then take your position next to Yaakov to be the material source of blessing for the Jewish people. And that is why he concludes in this piece that Esav went out for the hunt. For once, for the purpose, lehavi, to bring it home. So he picks up on the language when Rivka quotes it in verse 5. Rivka shomas bedaber Yitzchak el Esav. And now Rivka overheard her husband Yitzchak speaking with her son Esav. Vayelech Esav hasadah latzud tzayin lehavi. And Esav went out to hunt game lehavi, to bring it back. Why is there the extra latzud tzayin lehavi, to bring it back? That's unique. Generally, was latzut tzayid, it was to hunt game for the sake of hunting game. But now he's gone out with his father's command to do it for someone else. And that was Yitzchak's hope. That was the hope that there'd be two sons who would partner together, one in the material, one in the spiritual. Esav, of course, being the material, and so he gives him a bracha that allows him to channel all of that. But meanwhile, Rivka's on to this. Rivka knows that Esav, he's just not part of the equation. He doesn't want to be part of it, and therefore has her son Yaakov be a man of the field, so to speak, to pretend that he can play that game, to get dressed up, to go in and to steal the blessings and to take all of that for now what would become the legacy of Avram to Yitzchak, who now all go only within the family of Yaakov. Okay, one last piece. Verse 12, Kimisatea, let's read it inside, it's right above. This is Yaakov's complaint. Yaakov says to his mother, I don't know if this is a good idea. Now he does, and remember, he does not say it's not a good idea because it's deceptive. He says it's not a good idea, I'm going to get caught. Exactly. Let's read the pasuk inside. Ulai musheini avi. Maybe my father will feel me. V'ha'isi ve'einav kimisatea, and I will be like a deceiver. V'hevesi alai klolo v'lo bracha. And therefore he will bring upon me a curse and not a bracha. This is a bad idea, mom. And she says, upon my head is your curses. This is something we need to do. And she sends him in. Rav Hirsch comments, verse 12, as a cheat, as one who would deceive somebody. The Chaf explains everything. Hayisi be'enav ke misateya. I will appear in his eyes like a deceiver, says Rav Hirsch. Jacob, Yaakov, was no cheat. He did not want to deceive. But he is afraid he would not be given time to explain to his father that he was only blindly obeying his mother. He says, I was not going to have time to say, you're right, I got caught. Let me explain to you what happened, Dad. You see, you wanted to give the bracha to my older brother, Esav. But Mom knows that Esav really is not who you think he is. So he sent me in to give you, to get all dressed up and to fool you. But really, it's not, this isn't really who I am or what I'm like. He's not going to be able to do all of that. If he gets caught by his father on the spot, he's immediately going to be cursed. Yitzchak would at once curse him for trying to deceive him. But thereby he also told her indirectly and in the most respectful manner how objectionable the whole affair seemed to him as a deception meriting being cursed. So on this last point, we said he never said it's wrong. He just said, I'm going to get caught. Says the first, read his words carefully. He's saying, Mom, this is wrong. Because what did he say? I'm going to get caught and be cursed instead of blessed. Why would you be cursed? Because doing something like this merits being cursed. This is the wrong thing to do. And therefore, says Afersh, in a very kind and respectful manner, he mentions, I don't think this is right. It's not appropriate. But meanwhile, his mother says, it's upon me, this is something that must be done, and she sends him in. Okay, that is Refersh. So this in essence is going to conclude our second session. One other thing, let me just mention the Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim Volozhin, who was a student of the Vilna Gaon in the late 1700s and 1800s, writes Kabbalistically. So I'm not really going to mention. I'm not going to discuss it. Just going to mention it in regards to this last question that we asked. Why does Yitzchak demand food? It seems like a very odd thing to demand food. To bless. So he writes a piece. Again, I'm just going to mention it. I'm not equipped to really talk about it. But here, Refersh's approach really has nothing to do with Yitzchak. It really has everything to do only with Esav. The reason why I want you to go out and make me a meal is not because I need a meal, but because you need to be engaged in providing for me to be able to truly merit the blessings of materialism which I want to bestow upon you. That's how Rav Hirsch looks at it. So you say, like, why is he making a meal? It's not because he needs a meal. It's the wrong way to phrase the question. It's that he needs Esav to prepare a meal. I need you to be engaged in someone else to merit the materialistic bracha that I'd like to bestow upon you. The other approach that Chaim Volozhin writes, from a more Kabbalistic approach, is the combination of body and soul. Again, there's a whole long piece on this. That the two, are, once we're created, they might have been separate at some point, but once we're created, they become fused together. And that there's an interaction between body and soul. And that there is a mechanism through the elevation of the body that indeed the soul becomes elevated as well. There's a nourishment of the soul, A, that takes place through spiritual endeavors. The person learns Torah, performs mitzvahs, kind deeds. There's an elevation of the soul through that. And that there's a reality that somehow through the physical activities that the body is involved in creates also a deeper connection to the soul. That they become almost as one, if I'm saying it over accurately, which I'm hesitant and afraid that I'm not, but that there's another approach that somehow understanding how the two function together, that there is something out there. I'm going to leave it at that because it's beyond my understanding. But just to be aware that that's the other approach out there to this big question, aside from Hirsch's, which is really is more from Esau's perspective, is that it really is more from Yitzchok's perspective. That he needs, just like you sometimes, a good music can put you in a different type of mood. You could accomplish things in that way. So good food also does that. Ein simchel bebasar b'yayin. The true joy in the times of the Beis HaMikdash was having meat and wine. And somehow there's an interaction between body and soul, and things that the body can do to give it pleasure allows the soul to soar to different heights as well and accomplish what it needs to do. That is the other approach. But in any case, let us summarize and conclude. That's episode number 2. And we'll lead into what we'll start Mirtzah Shem next week. First episode was their birth. Their birth and the selling of their birthrights. Second episode, which we just concluded, which we did mostly before the summer, was the brachas, in which Yaakov, in effect, steals the bracha. As I first pointed out last week, Chazal have some things to say that we paid the price for it. The tears that Esav shed when he discovered that he had been swindled are the tears which we will shed over hundreds of generations in payment for those tears. It was not clear that this was may have been the only way to do it, but it caused pain. And when one causes pain to someone else, there's a ramification of that, and we have suffered, as the Medrash have said, because of this. Yet, when you look at it from each one's perspective, as I first pointed out, you can understand each one. Yaakov was really just being the obedient son. His respectful protest comes in his words, "I'm going to be cursed," meaning this is the wrong thing to do, it leads to a curse. But otherwise, he's just the obedient son. Yitzchak, who was fooled, but was fooled only in thinking that his son Esav, who we understood very well, was going to be materialistic in nature, but he was fooled into thinking that materialism would be partnered together with Yaakov. And Rivka, who knew better, who grew up in the house of Lavan, who was not fooled by Esav, who knew that he wanted nothing to do with the partnership, thought that the only way to get Yitzchak to realize the truth was to actually show him that it is feasible and not even so hard to deceive him. And if Yaakov can pull it off, certainly Esav can pull it off, and that's why she contrives this entire plan. That is how we first understand this episode. But in any case, just as a brief word before we break in introduction for next week, so the end of the story that we just finished, episode number 2, Yaakov has to flee. Esav says, I need to wait for my father to die, and then I'm going to kill him. Rivka finds out, as Rashi quotes, through the Malachim, through her Ruach HaKodesh, her divine inspiration, that Esav is planning on killing his brother Yaakov. So she says to her husband, you know what, why don't we send Yaakov to go find a wife for himself? Let's send him to my brother Lavan out in Haran. He'll go live there for a little bit. And she's thinking, there'll be a little bit of time, eventually Esav will come down and he'll come home. Of course, that amount of time turns into over 20 years. And he actually gets married. He has 4 wives. Rachel and Leah, you mentioned earlier, the Bilhah and Zilpah, 11 children, and then finally, this is at the beginning of Parshas, whatever, I'm blanking, whichever Parsha it is, at the beginning of that whole Parsha, where he goes to live there, and then at the end of that Parsha, he comes back. Then it's time to, he realizes that Laban has had enough of him, he's become a wealthy man, he has 11 children and 4 wives, it's time to go back, and that's Parshas Vayishlach, in which he sends messages to his brother Esav that he's coming back. And they have a whole interaction. He sends all the gifts. They have an entire dialogue. That's going to be the third episode, is the dialogue and the gifts between Yaakov and Esav, in which Esav says, let's walk together. And Yaakov says, no, thank you. That, the sages see in that, our 2,000-year exile. That's going to be the final episode, the final chapter of Yaakov and Esav, in which Esav says, we're at the end of that. That last, you have all the gifts and all that, and then he says, come, let's walk together. That's the Western world assimilation. Come, let's all be together and be one happy family. And Yaakov says, I have a different plan. You go on up ahead. I'll meet you there. And we're going to see within this interaction all that we need to know for this final episode in our history.
So if he would have walked with him, that's the Klaus, or would have been assimilated and...
Yeah, that's what it sounds. You know, if you when you work through the hint, that's Yaakov's approach to stay true to who he wants to be. Is you go on ahead, and I'll catch you later. So what we'll do is next week we'll start with the psukim. We'll do it the same way we've done the other 2 episodes. We'll go through the psukim. We'll ask all the questions on the episode as we can. Then we'll go through Rashi. We'll go through Ramban. We'll read through Rav Hirsch, and then hopefully by next summer we'll have finished that third episode. All right. Have a great day. For those of you who do catch up online with this class,
And if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.